Meeting is called to order. Good morning, members, and also welcome to the other committee members who are joining us this morning from Bioscience and Emerging Technologies Committee, Agriculture and Rural Economics and Veterans Affairs Division Committee, and the full Environment and Natural Resources Committee. So we are glad to have everyone here. We're looking forward to the presentation. And with that, welcome, Dean. And if you'd put your name on the record, and let's get started.
Thank you, Representative Virginia, members of the committees. My name is Robert Eldy. I serve as Dean of the College of Biological Sciences and Chair of the University of Minnesota's Initiative in Renewable Energy and Environment. Very pleased to be with you this morning. There are a variety of issues and forces that bring this to the forefront, and many of you have participated in hearings that have been happening in the last few days, last couple of weeks, and will continue this for the next couple of weeks. Pleased today that we also have the opportunity to piggyback on a symposium that's being held at the University of Minnesota this afternoon, and we have, as a consequence, some early risers from our guests here this morning: John Sheehan from the National Renewable Energy Lab from the DOE, Golden, Colorado; Eric Larson from Princeton; and Alexander Farrell from University of California, Berkeley. So we will try to be concise in our remarks and lay the groundwork for what we hope can be a productive discussion this morning. Today, I'll try to very briefly give you an overview of where we are today with biofuels, where we're going, and what is still needed to get us to a sustainable future with biofuels as a part of our economy. The first generation of biofuels has been certainly interesting, and the state of Minnesota, you and your colleagues, have been crucially important in putting incentives so that Minnesota has taken the lead in the nation in terms of mandating the use of biofuels in the form of ethanol in our gasoline and biodiesel as a fraction of our diesel that is sold at the pumps in Minnesota. It's really been, I think, an amazing demonstration project as a biologist that you can actually use photosynthesis. You remember, maybe you remember how to spell it from ninth grade biology. That process that really sustains life on Earth captures carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and converts it into plant matter. And that within a few weeks of photosynthesis, you can harvest those plants and convert them into a high energy content fuel to use for transportation. So in that sense, it's been really an amazing demonstration project, and we're all proud of the role Minnesota, our colleagues in the producer community and the ethanol community have made in demonstrating this. I mean, who would have thunk it a decade ago that you could really do this? And it's been done on a very large scale. However, we're staring down what is emerging as a food versus fuel conflict. That food versus fuel conflict is because the current way we produce ethanol is from the same, very same source that we use for feeding livestock and feeding ourselves. That is the kernels of corn. And as Dave Tillman and his colleagues have pointed out in a paper earlier this summer, that if we dedicated all of the U.S. corn and soybean crops to biofuels, we'd only meet 12% of U.S. gasoline demand and 6% of diesel demand. So that illustrates pretty clearly this food versus fuel challenge that we're facing. There are other aspects of this challenge in terms of the way we would produce the corn and soybeans, and there are some very interesting opportunities on the horizon with mechanisms that we might be able to use to restore health to many of our agro-ecosystems. And so we'd like to review that briefly this morning. The National Renewable Energy Lab has mapped the biomass resources of the U.S. You've probably seen this, and no surprise, the breadbasket of America is also the fuel basket of America. There is huge potential in terms of biomass. If we could harvest the energy content that's latent within the cellulose and the lignocellulose, complex polymers that comprise the wall of plants, that could be used as an alternative to the easily accessible sugar from the starch of crops like corn. What we're looking toward in the future is a system that's more complicated, but has more possible inputs in terms of feedstocks and more outputs in terms of types of fuel that could be used. And this is called the biorefinery. that we have a piece of it to date in the form of our ethanol plants, where we take starch from corn in Minnesota. We ferment it using organisms that were essentially known to humankind maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years ago when the first people began making beer and wine. We take that sugar essentially make beer and distill the alcohol out of that and use it as a fuel content. There are, of course, side products that are used can be used in a variety of ways. The biorefinery of the future will take more complex plant materials in the form of biomass itself approach, take that and using various methods of mechanical and thermal pretreatment, break it apart, and then further break the molecules down using enzymes specifically engineered and designed to break down and harvest the sugars that are inherent in cellulose. And it's not only 6-carbon sugars, but there are also, if you're a biology nerd, there are other kinds of sugars that are amenable to harvesting energy content. But the integrated biorefinery of the future will have also a thermochemical conversion platform. And in fact, gasification of biomass is already a technology that has great promise. And that can be used either directly on the biomass as it starts, or it can be used as from the lignin byproducts that come out of the fermentation process and create additional heat and power by creating synthesis gas. So what we're seeing overall is where we've been living for 100 to 150 years on a fairly simplistic energy platform, the fossil fuel platform. We've used coal and we've used crude oil, and those have been the two basic inputs to our energy platform. And the outputs have been electricity and transportation fuels. We're looking down the future at a future that has a much more nuanced and complex series of biomass as feedstock. That biomass will differ dramatically as to what part of the country we're talking about, the kinds of crops that can be grown, the kind of forests that can be nurtured, and around the world, the various kinds of crops that can be harvested in niches around the world. So this represents a serious and fundamental biological challenge as to how to harvest the energy content that's latent in diverse biomass. It's also the case that, as you see on the right-hand side, that the products, in terms of a variety of fuels, new fuels that have interesting properties, in some cases properties more interesting than gasoline and diesel itself, and a variety of products that currently are derived from petroleum, from crude oil. But as I said just a moment ago, there are many scientific challenges. It's theoretically feasible. There's been great and dramatic progress thanks to major investments by the Department of Energy in engineering enzymes. But we've hit a glass ceiling, if you will, in our ability to further optimize the efficiency of enzymes needed to break down cellulose. And we've barely begun to find and discover enzymes that can break down the more recalcitrant polymers that you find in wood. Trees are tall because they have more complex, tougher polymers in the form of lignin that's hybridized with cellulose, and there's a lot of energy that's latent there. So we find ourselves here in Minnesota at the intersection of the three great biomes, the three great land zones, and the plants that grow in those land zones within the central United States. The prairies to the west, the deciduous forests from the south, and the boreal or evergreen coniferous forests from the north. And there are interesting opportunities in each of those biomes for harvesting in sustainable ways energy from the plants that can grow and the photosynthesis that created those plants. So I've listed here, just in cartoon form, some of the products beyond ethanol. So we talked about second generation feedstocks, that is going beyond corn and soybeans in terms of biomass, and particularly biomass grown from diverse crops. And we also look at a variety of other products that come out the pipeline, if you will, and can fuel and provide the basis for chemical building blocks for other very interesting materials. I'll say more about one of these in particular, I think, in the next slide. And this is an illustration courtesy of Volvo, Volvo Powertrains. Volvo Powertrains is the largest manufacturer of large diesel engines in the world. Dave Kittleson, who heads our University of Minnesota Center for Diesel Research, is a partner with Volvo Powertrains. And together, they've come to the conclusion that an extremely interesting substitute for petroleum-based diesel is a product that can be derived from biomass, and in fact, it can be derived, in some cases, from waste streams of current processing plants. This is a product abbreviated DME. It means dimethyl ether. I won't go into the chemical structure of dimethyl ether, but consider it to be a chemical relative. It behaves a lot like propane. So Kittleson and his colleagues have determined that diesel engines, without serious modifications, will run very, very well on dimethyl ether if you just change the fuel tanks and the injection systems. So this looks extremely interesting. And what is illustrated on this particular slide, again from Volvo, is that dimethyl ether is not only a high energy content fuel, that is, the energy content per unit mass is high. If you remember, there's been some issues related to the energy content of ethanol, because on a per mass basis, ethanol does not have as much energy content as gasoline. Dimethyl ether is nearly as good as diesel itself in that parameter. But what's really intriguing in light of issues of sustainability of using something like this, if you look at the right-hand side, the little blue bars on this graph indicate the greenhouse gas emissions as a consequence of using the renewable side. And so if you'll notice, DME, derived from wood or the black liquor, the waste stream from our pulp and paper mills up in northern Minnesota, is extremely interesting, both in its energy content and its essentially carbon neutral impact on greenhouse gas emissions. So this is just one of many examples of the variety of new and really intriguing fuels that could come out of moving toward a more sustainable way, and the technological innovations that will be required, both in creating those fuels and adopting engines and current uses of energy in a flex fuel mode, if you will, to optimize the use of these renewable fuels. So we can imagine there's been a lot of attention in this community because of our agricultural economy about the success of the ethanol industry. But we can also imagine analogous arrangements with forest products industry, where both forest products grown and cultivated for sustainable production of fuels, but also the byproducts of the current pulp and paper industry in the form of black liquor could be intriguing components of our portfolio of sustainably produced fuels. But we have challenges, as I've alluded to. We've illustrated here the complex structure of the cell wall of plants. We sometimes become deluded, given rapid progress in science, in some areas of science, that we know everything. And in fact, there's a lot we don't know. In fact, one of the surprising things is how little we know about the basic architecture of the wall of cells, of plants. And if we don't know the architecture, it's kind of tough to break it apart. We can use sledgehammers, but we need much more nuanced tools in the form of enzymes to break these molecular scaffolds apart. And so that's one of the challenges, as I indicate here in this first bullet point. In concert with this, we need to design and use the new systems biology approach. Systems biology is the new emerging discipline that follows genomics, it follows proteomics, it follows metabolomics. It's a totally new and integrated way of taking apart biological systems and simulating them. We need to use systems biology to design better enzymes, to reduce the cost of those enzymes, to break these constituents of the cell wall apart. We need to make serious progress in unlocking the energy that's latent in lignans, the tough stuff that comprises woody biomass. And we need to do a lot of work to enhance the toxic byproducts of the fermentation process that inhibits current enzymes. So, cellulosic or lignocellulosic ethanol or other second-generation biofuels are extremely interesting. They provide interesting opportunities for changing the landscape of our agro and forest ecosystems into production methods that are more sustainable, that are more diverse, that will enhance habitat for wildlife and fish. But at the moment, the costs are prohibitive. That is, the costs of a current cellulosic ethanol facility are on the order of 3 to 5 times those of a corn-based ethanol facility. We're extremely pleased with progress that we've been able to make thanks to action you took 4 years ago that enabled the creation of and financing of our university's initiative in renewable energy and the environment. And to remind you of that action, over this 5-year period, and we're 4 years into this, the university has been able to invest $20 million derived from the Conservation Improvement Program and from the Renewable Development Fund that was part of the Prairie Island reauthorization language, not without controversy, I remember, that enabled us to generate some projects, some of which I think are truly disruptive technologies. What are disruptive technologies? It's become a popular word in the word of fast-breaking economic circles. If you think about the iPod is perhaps the best example of a disruptive technology. The music industry has been disrupted forever as a consequence of the iPod. We're not going to change our use and procurement of fuels and energy unless we come up with both policies but also technologies that hit the market and disrupt business as usual. One of these disruptive technologies, I would argue, is the work that Dave Tillman, Jason Hill, and their colleagues published in the December 8th issue of Science Magazine. You've heard about it. David testified to that historic joint hearing here the other night. The disruptive part of their findings is that they have discovered a method, if we can scale it up, and we're intending to do so, of producing truly carbon negative, not carbon neutral, but carbon negative biofuels by restoring and growing diverse prairie species. This is truly disruptive. This can seriously change business as usual. There are 2 or 3 other things that are emerging from the investments you have made at the University of Minnesota that will further disrupt business as usual. And it's going to take this combination of the kind of policies and incentives you can put out and inventiveness on the part of coalitions of people here in Minnesota and elsewhere to change things. Just to summarize the work of Tillman et al., one derives with the same sort of input more than twice the biomass that you do if you grow any single species in monoculture, including switchgrass. As I said, carbon negative. We can go into describing what we mean by carbon negative. It's not immediately understandable, perhaps. It's very intriguing that the energy output of growing crops like this on marginal soils is far greater than the energy output of growing corn on fertile soils. And this presents amazing opportunities. Opportunities in places, for example, and we're in deep conversations with our colleagues and friends on the White Earth Reservation, who came to us and said, marginal lands, that's all we've got. So this really represents some really intriguing opportunities for economic development in areas of our state that have suffered, and so on. You can read this faster than I can read it to you. And at the heart of it, what is very intriguing is as we, as our grandparents and grandparents' parents planted prairies and settled these lands, we released carbon that was stored for eons in the soils of the tall grass and short grass prairies. By planting perennial crops and enabling those complex root and microbial systems to sequester carbon, we will, over decades, sequester more and more carbon on an incremental basis and help capture the incredible amounts of carbon that have been delivered to the atmosphere by our practices of fossil fuel utilization over the past century. There are scientific challenges. This reiterates this whole notion of the integrated biorefinery, where biomass is the input coming in and being treated biologically, biochemically with enzymes, but also being treated thermochemically to break it apart into its constituent elements that can be harnessed in real time I mean, let's get back to this in a certain sense. If we think about our dependency on fossil fuels, we've been dependent on photosynthesis for our energy. The problem is, the photosynthesis we've become addicted to is photosynthesis that occurred 200 to 300 million years ago and was converted by geological forces and time into coal and crude oil. We ought to be smart enough now in this post-genome biology to harvest the energy latent in photosynthesis in real, something closer to real time. And that's the scientific challenge at its heart. This has not gone unnoticed to people in other jurisdictions. Other states are jumping at the opportunities. We as a university just uploaded yesterday our submission, and we're in fierce competition with our colleagues at many other universities, some represented here, for the DOE's announced intention to create two essentially national centers for bioenergy research. We submitted this grant application. I showed it to the committee yesterday morning, the Bioscience Committee. It's about 4 inches thick. It's the largest grant application ever submitted in the history of the University of Minnesota for a total of $125 million over 5 years, should it happen. But we are led to believe that we're not the only one vying for this. We think there were 70 letters of intent filed in this competition, so we are one of 70 players. We hope we have a leg up thanks to the platform of our the investment you made in us several years ago. But both universities, states, and commercial entities are seeing the future, that there is an economic future in this challenge. I illustrate here just some of what has been going on around the country, and I won't read it to you. You can read it faster than I can to you. We're in a strong position, but it's not that we're just competing here within the Midwest or among states within the U.S. Countries are on fire. This is going to happen. The question is, who's going to develop the technology and how is it going to be deployed? We were just over a year ago once again in China and visited the world's largest ethanol plant. It's in Jinling, China. This is the world's largest ethanol plant. It has high-tech attributes beyond belief. But at its heart, the corn that is being brought to be converted into ethanol is harvested by hand. Harvested by hand at this ethanol plant. Countries around the world are seeing the opportunity, and the technology will be developed somewhere. I said to the business, to the Bioscience Committee yesterday morning, the question is, the place that invents this technology will have not only the benefits of producing sustainable biofuels, but will have the benefits of the technology that will be required everywhere in the world in the form of the enzymes, the membranes, and the doodads, if you will, that are required and need to be manufactured to supply this, what will certainly be a very long run in terms of producing fuel from things we can grow. Now, we're certainly sanguine enough to realize that biofuels are not, some have said biofuels are the jet stream over here in this legislative session, and whereas I think that's true in some sense, biofuels are not the only answer. Absolutely critical for this whole effort is conservation. I mean, our first and the biggest steps are how can we become more energy efficient, how can we conserve, and there are many, many other sectors that need to be addressed. It's very interesting how, if you think about plug-in hybrids, how the electric grid is merging. I mean, the electric grid we didn't used to think about as in terms of a component of the transportation solution, right? But it is. So there's blurring of the distinction between these sectors, but there's a lot of work that needs to happen in each of these sectors. Just briefly, the investments that we have made thanks to the action you took 4 years ago are illustrated in this pie chart. A large fraction of the investments in the work that we've done at the university in our initiative for renewable energy environment are in fact in this bio energy space. And in fact, most of the hydrogen research that we've invested in has been in bio-based approaches to making hydrogen, and so on. So we've been really preparing in anticipation of the future that we're seeing more vividly today. I'm also pleased that through the efforts of the Initiative in Renewable Energy and the Environment, we've been able to partner with with all of the coordinate campuses of the University of Minnesota and our research and outreach centers. So this is not something stuck here in the Twin Cities metro area. We've also partnered Illustrator here in the process for this DOE application, both on education, research, and demonstration with the White Earth community and with our partners at the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute and with our partners in several of MNSCU's institutions, as well as some private colleges here in Minnesota. And then two of our really legendary institutions that participate in informal science education, the Science Museum of Minnesota, as well as Wolfridge Environmental Learning Center. So I think we've really found ways to partner and find synergistic possibilities and differential roles that we all play in moving us forward and creating the pipeline of students who need to come and do this and succeed us older folks as we move toward the sustainable future. So what does this future look like? For me, the future looks like a state of innovation, as we know we are. To allude to our innovation in the past, we know that we were the state and the university that helped create the medical device industry. As I said yesterday, every time a pacemaker is installed somewhere in the world, that person who receives the pacemaker receives the personal health benefits of that technology. That community, that hospital, in which that hospital that installs the pacemaker derives economic benefit from installing that pacemaker because people work in those hospitals or employed, and that community just derives economic benefit. But every time a pacemaker is installed somewhere in the world, it's likely that there's at least a little bit of a ka-ching in Minnesota's economy because the companies that make those pacemakers are mostly headquartered here in Minnesota. We need to have that same leadership role in terms of inventing the technology that creates the second and third generation of feedstocks and biofuels and the kinds of energy utilization systems that use those biofuels. This will help us, I think, realize the ethos that many of us feel that Minnesota has in terms of our stewardship of the natural resources and environment we enjoy in this part of the world. And it's also an amazing opportunity to really turn on its head the challenges that rural economies, economies in our rural communities have faced through some really hard times. There are really great opportunities here. So we see this as a convergence and not just a twofer, but a threefer or a fourfer in solving some of our most pressing problems. Thank you for your attention, and I'd like to now call your attention to the symposium that we're pleased to be hosting this afternoon. Since we know that many of you will not be able to be at the symposium, we have a preview, a sneak preview of that symposium in the form of our colleagues who I alluded to at the beginning. And with that, we'll introduce them, and maybe my colleague Dick Henningsen can help you put their PowerPoints at the top, and in turn, you could introduce them in order. While this is being converted, if you have questions, I'd be happy to try to address any questions on the fly.
Are there questions at this point, members? Yes, Representative Osmer.
Well, thank you, Danielle. Do you understand that with regard to the Department of Energy grants that the University of Minnesota is looking to compete for, that there's some concern about the funding of that grant right now? The Department of Energy is going back on that? Is there some way that we can, who should we be talking to or contacting about that?
And Chair, Representative Osmond, it's a very poignant question given that our colleague John Sheehan from the Department of Energy's Renewable Energy Lab is now about to address us. It turns out that on close analysis through the last 6 years of current administration, investments in renewable energy have been essentially flat, and the increase and the current roadblock in Congress is a result of the failure for Congress to pass budgets for most of the federal agencies, and they're operating on continuing resolutions. There's a strong push in Congress now to enact those budgets and to get out of this gridlock. But I would just like to add that the President, in his State of the Union message just a couple of weeks ago, indicated this bold plan forward. And I have to say that he announced that there would be $1.6 billion in his 2008 budget plan to be allocated over the next 10 years for renewable energy cellulosic ethanol research. That adds up to $160 million per year, which I'm sorry to say, in the terms of research funding for a moonshot like this, is really a drop in the bucket. So I think, to answer your question, we need to really work closely with our members of our congressional delegation and their colleagues to realize the nature of the effort that's going to be required to get from here to there, including the funding of these centers. And with that, I'd like to introduce our colleague, John Sheehan, from the National Renewable Energy
Lab. I have several other questions for you, so we could...
I'll wait on mine.
You want to wait on yours? Representative Eakin has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I had a question also dealing with the same thing Representative Osment was addressing, the grant application. What could be done on our level to bring that home, to bring it to Minnesota? It seems to me that the national government, the federal government, is going to be looking at states that are moving forward themselves because they're going to want to partner with states that are making major investments in such technology. Is there something that we can do in this session that would help bring that home?
Chair, Representative Eakin, it's a really good question, and I'm grateful for your interest and support. You know, this process going forward is really a scientific peer review process that should be relatively unfettered by the political process and pressure that might be brought to bear. That's the intention of this this effort on the part of the Department of Energy. And I think science in the United States has benefited from that unfettered peer review process. So at one level, I think our best thing to do is let the chips fall where they may, assuming that the peer review process will find our application to be very meritorious and it will just happen. On the other hand, you know, whether we're so fortunate to be funded or not, I can't tell you how pleased I am with the 48 inaugural research projects and the 9 educational projects that are found in that. I mean, they didn't just fall out. That was the work over months of many, many of our very, very best faculty. So we are looking for ways that we might be able to pull those out in some sort of cluster arrangement and see how we might jumpstart those with funding that we might be able to find more locally here. So I think another conversation could be productive in finding out ways that we might both influence the federal process, particularly by pressure to increase the allocation for this type of research relative to other areas of science, and then other ways that we as a community might really push ahead some of the most promising work.
Representative Cornish.
Sometimes ethanol plants and ethanol producers get kind of a bad rap. They think they're just putting in the corn, turning off the ethanol, and making money in the big business, and they don't care about the environment. But are you aware personally of all the research that they're doing themselves, like Brewing Company is one of the biggest ethanol producers, the grants that they're getting and do cellulose, you know, research and partnering with China, and all of the fermentation scientific evidence that they're producing, and the good things too? I mean,
Madam Chairman, Representative, yes, I mean, I don't think we're aware of everything, but we're certainly in close contact, and you know, I have to say that I think we're very closely aligned with the Corn Growers Association in Minnesota and nationally. I have a great deal of respect. I think these are people who take risks, who are scientists in their own right, who are experimentalists. I think, having grown up in a farm community in Washington State, I think principally farmers are scientists. They're experimentalists, they're observing things, and I think that carries over into their, especially producer-owned ethanol plants, as well as the larger ethanol plants. So innovation will come out of all quarters. I think the role that research universities play is taking that research that has a longer horizon and has a riskier profile, some of which will never materialize into something, but that's the role we play, and there's a continuum of expertise, and I'm so pleased that, you know, with our proposal to the DOE, we're partnered with those people.
If we could continue now, I see no more questions.
So, with that, our colleague John Sheehan from the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado.
Excuse me, I missed a question. Representative Knuth, please.
Hopefully this is a fairly quick one. I think we're all pretty excited about the prospect of, I think, the $10 million we've invested in IRE getting a $125 million grant, but it's how much outside research funding from the federal government or private or anywhere have you leveraged through IRE to this point?
Madam Chair, Representative, we've at the moment leveraged $14 million by our calculations.
Thank you. If we could proceed now.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm very pleased to be here. My name is John Sheehan. I am a senior strategic analyst at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, where I have been working on, for most of my 15 years there, working in the area of biofuels, including ethanol and biodiesel. And I'll tell you, these are really exciting times for me right now. I've seen some real ups and downs, and this is the biggest up I think I've ever seen. And it's a privilege to be here in Minnesota, where I think some of the most aggressive efforts to not only focus on the fuels, but focus on the infrastructure issues that are required to make these fuels happen. You know, there's a lot we can learn at our national lab about these, how to approach these infrastructure questions just by looking at how they've been handled here in Minnesota. So I'm very, very pleased to be here. I want to make just a few very brief comments. I'm going to kind of float over most of my slides, which I will be using this afternoon at the biofuels workshop, to highlight a couple of key points. So let me jump right in. I always like to start with my philosophical soapbox, which is this question of sustainable development. Biofuels, I think we all agree, have tremendous potential to address what the biologist E.O. Wilson calls very appropriately the ethic of sustainable development. And he talks about that as a complex problem that is technological, it's economic, it's scientific, it's political, and it's ethical. And so we are grappling with one of the most difficult sets of questions we can possibly want to struggle with. And with that, sort of, I put that a bit negatively, there is a huge opportunity here to look at the energy resources of both the state, the nation, and the world in a context of creating a new sustainable energy form. These opportunities don't come along very often. It's an opportunity you see perhaps every couple hundred years. And in that context, I like to, you know, caution us to make sure that as we move ahead looking at biofuels, we are very careful to make sure that we do it right. That certainly is one of my main focuses in my research at NREL. I just happened to see this article in the New York Times a few days ago where the Europeans putting a huge demand on using palm oil as a renewable resource for energy have unwittingly created other economic problems. So, again, I think that the right approach is this broad approach that doesn't just say we're going to find a technological solution, but we're going to look at how to implement that solution in the best and most responsible way. Dr. Eldy's done a nice job of giving you an overview of the biomass issues and the technologies involved, so I don't need to spend a whole lot of time there. What I will say about the technologies that are in play, as you heard, there are really biological processes, what I call biochemical processes, the fermentation processes to make ethanol, and there are thermochemical processes. And in fact, a lot of people like to talk about these technologies as though it's a choice of one versus the other. In fact, that's quite wrong. In work that I have done with Eric Larson who at Princeton, who you'll hear from shortly, we've looked at how you combine these types of technologies to achieve levels of sustainable and economic production that neither one of these technologies can achieve on their own. And I think that's a very important message and a very important direction in moving forward. So much so that really what our goal is with this technology is to look at the benchmark of what the petroleum refining industry can do in terms of its efficiencies after 150 years of development, and that's the goal. We want to make this technology that efficient. And what we've seen is only by combining all of these pieces, gasification technology, fermentation technology, can we start to move toward processes that look as effective as what the petroleum industry can do today. Very briefly on the question of, well, what's the potential for biomass? Well, it depends. The numbers that are out there can be at times confusing. Here you'll see a range of four sets of numbers that vary by a factor of three in terms of how much biomass is out there. And behind those differences are questions of how are we going to view the future of agriculture. If agriculture looks like it looks today, we might be looking at the smaller set of numbers. If there's going to be, as you put it, the kinds of disruptive changes in technologies and approaches in agriculture as well as in the conversion technologies, then there's real potential to get that supply up to the levels of, as a recent USDA DOE study suggested, of a billion tons per year. Madam Chair, I think I have a there a question?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I was looking at your slides so intently that I missed Representative Clark.
Yeah, I was just wanting to know what the words Perlack and Milbrandt meant on there. Maybe everybody else knows, but I don't.
Oh, what that is? That is a reference to a study called, we refer to as the Billion Ton Study. I can leave information with a link to NREL and DOE's websites where that report can be downloaded. It's a report we finished about 2 years ago in which we asked the question, if we want biomass to be a serious player, how much energy, how much is really out there? I mean, is it a big player? And we posited to be a player, we needed to be looking at a supply that's at least a billion tons a year before the energy industry could take it seriously. And in effect, that study established that there is indeed that potential for a billion tons per year of usable biomass for fuels production. Okay, on the question of climate change, I have gotten more than a few gray hairs looking at this question in terms of the details, detailed analysis that folks like Alex Farrell and Berkeley have done to understand, is there a net positive energy balance for making these fuels? And as a result, is there a real savings in, with respect to greenhouse gases? And the answer is, it really depends. Compared to gasoline, when we look at some of the cellulosic materials, the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions are quite substantial. Corn ethanol today is not as effective a greenhouse gas mitigation opportunity, but it could be. And another sort of, I think, false choice that gets put forward is, are we talking about corn ethanol versus cellulosic ethanol? And the answer is no. That the corn ethanol industry is going to be the home for this new technology. And in fact, as they adopt the use of cellulosic materials in their own plants, they will simply move down this chart into the realm of very, very low greenhouse gas emission opportunities. And companies like Broin, as was mentioned, are real leaders in looking to adopt that technology. So, real aggressive growth in the corn ethanol industry with an aggressive target in 2012 under the current National Renewable Fuel Standard of 7.5 billion gallons of ethanol by 2012. Planned construction for these facilities already exceeds that goal. So, this, in effect, has become moot, which is good news. The new technology, again, described very well in the previous presentation you heard. What are we really aiming at for the fermentation processes? We're aiming at technologies that merge, instead of having separate production of an enzyme and its use to break cellulose down to sugar and then an organism to ferment it, really the nirvana, if you will, of the technology is an all-in-one organism that could get you there. That's truly disruptive, that's a big leap, and it's going to take some research to get there. With respect to the timing of the technology, how long are we going to be waiting? I'm sure this is a question that's on a lot of people's minds. I've been at the lab for 15 years. NREL has been around for close to 30 years. And, you know, where is this technology today? Well, at this point, as part of putting together a really aggressive target that the Department of Energy was developing over the last 2 years. They came up with a target they called 30 by 30. Unfortunately, there's a little bit of sloganeering that goes into developing these targets, but the concept here is, can we get 30% of our current gasoline consumption replaced by biofuels by the year 2030. That is a very aggressive goal. And so part of the message I want to leave with you is there are a lot of near-term opportunities, but we've got to keep our eye on the prize in terms of how long it's going to take to really build this industry. And I've been doing a lot of modeling work trying to look at how we can move forward. If you compare the cost of cellulosic ethanol technology with the market price for gasoline, you can see that we have a target to reach effectively a price in the year 2015 with a commercial process that is essentially competitive with gasoline. But in point of fact, that's not good enough. If you want to put a new industry in, you have to be better. You have to be truly disruptive in order to move such a well-established industry and marketplace. So this long-term goal for the sort of all-in-one nirvana I talked about gets us to a price target that is substantially lower than gasoline and really can start making the industry move. And some of the modeling results I've done, just looking at prairie grasses like switchgrass and ag residues like corn stover, show that we could be seeing well over a billion tons of this kind of agricultural biomass in play. But we're talking about a period of time of 20 to 50 years before it becomes really reaches its full potential. And in fact, we've looked at scenarios to say, what will it take to get there? Well, it's really going to take a combination not only of good technology, but also policies. So achieving 30 by 30, which is effectively 60 billion gallons of ethanol per year in the marketplace by the year 2030, doesn't happen easily under a scenario of so-called sort of business-as-usual oil prices. But under higher oil prices and with some government incentives, we can definitely reach that 60 billion gallon target. But a lot of patience. And finally, my closing slide here, I just want to mention that and this was brought up in the previous presentation, biofuels is not the answer. It is going to be a combination of conservation and efficiency improvements in addition to new fuels technology that are going to get us to the point perhaps 50 years from now when we will no longer be using petroleum in our transportation sector. Thank you. And Madam Chair, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. Members, are there questions? Yes, I suspect that there would be. Representative Peterson is first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to either of you, from you, okay, yes, but you had mentioned feedstock handling and pretreatment,
yes,
of this biomass, and maybe development of this at the existing corn ethanol plants. I'm wondering how much applied research or people on the ground or people or percent dedicated to the feedstock handling and the pretreatment is currently going on. Because I represent an ethanol plant that is moving towards their gasification project completion, hopefully. And what I'm hearing from them is that they need help with the handling and the pretreatment. Because I think they've got their gasification unit figured out at this stage of the game. But are wondering if they need people to let them know and help them with, the amount of biomass, the harvesting of it, the transport of it, should it be compacted before it goes into the gasifier? Does it go in loose? Is it bales? Is it loose straw? I mean, what is it? I mean, that's what I'm hearing from them, is that they need help because they've got the technology already. It's the logistics of getting it into the plant.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's an area where I would not say that's a large part of the research. We really are focused more on the conversion technology. But we do have researchers at Idaho National Laboratory who are explicitly looking at these questions of feedstock handling and collection. And we have experts at NREL who have looked at the issues of how do you handle biomass and feed it into a gasifier, as an example. And I would be pleased to, you know, leave some contact information so that folks can contact some of the experts that are working in that area.
We're going to take two more questions, Representative Clark and then Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered if you could tell me, you mentioned that there's a lot of research going on for the type of microbial organisms that are needed for the breakdown. Can you tell me who some of the partners are that are working on that?
Madam Chair, Representative, the partnerships, some of that work is likely to really get a boost as a result of this bioscience initiative that is currently underway. I think that's going to put a real shot in the arm in terms of some of the basic biology that needs to get done there. But researchers at universities, at Dartmouth College, at universities around the country and around the world, companies like Novozymes Biotech, Genencor International, two of the leading industrial enzyme producers, have been some of the biggest partners that the Department of Energy has worked with in at least developing the initial phase of enzyme technology development.
And sure, since I'm not exactly sure how to spell the names of those, or could you give me that information? I'd like to know. Follow up with it.
I can provide that offline. Yes.
Representative Mo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. More of a strategic question to either one of you. We've heard a lot here in this legislative session, and I think just about everybody's accepted climate change is real. We have great opportunities to show leadership in the state, or in this state, in developing biofuels, in particular in ways that are environmentally advantageous, prairie grass, using wood biomass where I live. However, everything is hinging upon our succeeding, or your succeeding, and your research is succeeding in actually developing these enzymes. And it seems fairly high stakes at this one point that we're actually going to do that. And not that I have any, I believe that ultimately you will, but perhaps you could give us a little insight into the calculations or likelihood that everything hinging upon this one success is actually going to come through for us.
Madam Chair, Representative, very, very good question. The enzyme technology development work has gone extremely well. Genencor and Novozymes, the two industrial enzyme partners that we've worked with, have had real successes. We are now seeing companies like DuPont and others actually working with these industrial partners, the enzyme developers, to actually put the enzymes into play in commercial technology. And the goal is that these companies will successfully demonstrate the technology, certainly in the 2010 to 2012 timeframe. And that's commercial scale, so that's a big advance. But there is absolutely a risk here that we do not have enough research pathways moving forward to ensure real success. The point is well taken that as resources and more funds become available, we desperately need to expand the number of approaches and pathways we've taken.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming this morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to now introduce our colleague from the University of California at Berkeley, Alexander Farrell.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you to the members of the committee and the guests, and also to my colleagues at the University of Minnesota. My name is Alex Farrell. I'm a professor of energy and resources at the University of California, Berkeley, and the director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center. I want to talk a little bit today about some things that are going on specifically in California that are relevant to and may be of interest to folks in Minnesota. So this is mostly a discussion that starts from a view that we need to cut greenhouse gases. And in California, I think we've been rather ahead of at least the federal government in recognizing this. We have actually quite a strategy. We have overall goals that have been set by Governor Schwarzenegger in 2005, enacted into law by the legislature last session in the California Global Warming Solution Act. This strategy includes not only goals, but a research portfolio, and I would emphasize what the dean has suggested. This has proven vital to our ability to respond, and I am encouraged by the research that you have supported at the University of Minnesota. In buildings and appliances, we have standards, in electricity, we have a number of things that are going on. But I'm here really to talk about transportation with you, in particular the vehicle performance standard and what we're calling the low carbon fuel standard. I may call it an LCFS as we go along here. California has set some ambitious targets. So you can see here on this figure, the black line is the trends. The target to really think about is this right here, the middle targets, where both in the legislature and signed by the governor, we're looking for a 25% cut in greenhouse gases by 2020. And we're doing that for two reasons. One reason is we think we can do it with existing technologies, and we also think that by taking this aggressive target, we can stimulate innovation in California and around the world to get where we need to go. So this short-term target of 25%, I think we can meet mainly with existing and near-term technologies. But in the longer term, we definitely need to stimulate innovation, as the dean was suggesting. And I would like to point out this particular bullet right here on the second one, that public policy really is needed here. And it's needed because technologies that are, development of new technologies is an expensive and risky business. And the reason that companies go into development of new technologies is because they see a commercial opportunity. They see a market. However, environmental markets tend to be very small and niches at best. And so when the main characteristic of a new technology is that it helps future generations by lowering greenhouse gas emissions, there's not much of a market there. And so the public policies to stimulate innovation is really important. Also, we see as one of the goals for our climate change strategy is strengthening the economy. And the reason is not just the usual reason this is good for our citizens. What is required to solve the climate change problem, of course, is a global agreement for global greenhouse gas reductions. How do we get there? We have to develop the technologies and prove that it's possible to cut greenhouse gas emissions and have a strong economy. And only after that is demonstrated in the developed countries, starting in, perhaps in California and other states, and in Europe and elsewhere, only after this has been demonstrated will other countries come along. And finally, there are also petroleum consumption reductions that are possible through a climate change strategy. So we have two pieces mainly. One piece is the vehicle greenhouse gas emission standard, sometimes called the Pavley bill. There are a number of different things that are involved in that. It's not an efficiency bill, it's actually greenhouse gas emissions. I don't want to say very much about that because I do want to talk mostly about this low carbon fuel standard. So this was announced by Governor Schwarzenegger 2 weeks ago in an executive order. And the idea is that emissions associated with the fuels themselves, separate from the efficiency of the vehicles, should go down by at least 10% by 2020. This will be implemented through a market-based system. And the reason for using a market-based system is that the other main approaches, subsidies and subsidized industries, tend to be prone to instability. And the use of market-based systems, a performance standard implemented through a market-based system, is that government has a pretty poor track record of picking technology winners. And actually, it's fair to say that the resources available to government for R&D are actually smaller relative to the resources that are available to private industry. So it's incentivizing private industry to conduct this innovation. That is the key. I'd like to note that there are similar proposals now in the United Kingdom. The Renewable Transportation Fuel Obligation, RTFO, in the United Kingdom has almost exactly the same language. And just yesterday, the European Commission proposed in a new directive to implement a low-carbon fuel standard that is essentially exactly the same. This idea that we will measure the global warming impact of the fuels that we sell in transportation is growing around the world, and I think it's going to have a transformative effect. Of course, when we think about this, we have to think about the well-to-wheel emissions. I know that you're all quite familiar with the fact that producing ethanol, producing other biofuels is a complex process, and that emissions occur at all stages of production. However, this is not as simple as it looks. One of the real issues is where do you draw the boundaries? And so, for instance, a serious question in California is if we are going to be importing low-carbon biofuels from Minnesota, how far upstream do we look, and how much do we look into the things that go into, for instance, ethanol production? What if some of the fertilizer that goes into corn production comes from China, where a lot of the fertilizer is produced with coal? Do we actually count that? Can we count that? Because you better believe that those greenhouse gas emissions are part of the problem. And this is not a simple question either from an analytical standpoint nor from a legal or regulatory standpoint. The rules of this are not really settled at all. We're just beginning to think about how to implement a low-carbon fuel standard. Compliance, however, is likely to be as far upstream as possible, blenders, refiners, and importers into the state. It's the entire global warming impact, and it's just carbon dioxide. And we will measure this. And it's actually the protocols for measuring this, the carbon content of the global warming impact that is an important part of our research. There are not a lot of things that can be done. So even in the petroleum sector, improving energy efficiency, reducing greenhouse gas leaks, stopping flaring, a number of things that the petroleum industry could do to moderately improve and their global warming impact. But one of the things they can obviously do is to blend low-carbon fuels, biofuels in particular, as long as they are certified to have low-carbon inputs. It's also possible to introduce new alternative fuels that have low greenhouse gases. Could be electricity, like the dean mentioned, or hydrogen, perhaps, or biofuels. There are new biofuels, biobutanol, or even DME that one could create from biomass products. They are all a little bit different. And then the last note there is that you could also buy credits. Credits are inherent on this because we want the market to be able to operate. The idea is that overachievers will generate emission reduction credits that they sell to underachievers. So maybe the Valero refinery is able to blend a lower greenhouse gas content that is actually required than is actually required. That would generate a few extra credits, and maybe there's a refinery down in Southern California that, for whatever reason, isn't quite able to meet the standard on their own, and so they buy those credits. Overall, the performance standard is met, but costs are reduced. And this flexibility allows companies to innovate, to develop low-cost strategies that matches their capital budget cycles, for instance, and satisfies their customers. Importantly, we're not picking winners with this. The technologies will compete. And notice that there's a wide array of technologies that are going to compete, not just biofuels with each other, biofuels with plug-in electric hybrid vehicles, biofuels with maybe hydrogen fuel cells. And this approach works. We know it because we've seen it. It has a successful track record in the very same industry. Similar approaches were used to phase out lead in gasoline in the 70s. Similar approaches are used today for reformulated gasoline blends. And for a long time, under the Clean Air Act, criteria pollutants have used similar emission reduction credit programs. The opportunities, I don't think I need to mention, new fuels have really a potential for huge greenhouse gas emission reductions, or they may not. And this distinction up until now has not made a lot of difference. In fact, if I wanted to go buy a low greenhouse gas ethanol at a local distributor in California, I wouldn't know how to do it. There's no labeling. And if I wanted to encourage other people to do so as a legislature, I wouldn't know how to do it because we don't measure any of these things. So there is a lot of work left to go. I also want to note that California is like Minnesota in that we are also developing a biomass strategy. We consume just a little bit under a billion gallons of ethanol a year. Only 5 or 6% of that is produced in state. And we want to produce more in state for similar reasons that folks here want to produce biofuels. We have a number of things that are underway. One is the Alternative Fuels Act of 2005, AB 1007. And we're undertaking a well-to-wheel study about how we might be able to improve the amount of biofuels that are created in-state. There is a biomass collaborative, which is housed at UC Davis, which is helping in research, demonstration, education in these areas. The Governor Schwarzenegger actually signed an executive order in the fall last year that establishes non-binding goals for California-sourced biofuels. And the idea is that 20% of our biofuel consumption, we hope, will be from in-state by 2010 and reaching 75% by 2050. These are ambitious goals, and we'll see what are good strategies for that. But let me point you out to the last bullet. I'm pleased to announce that just today, Governor Schwarzenegger and also Governor Blagojevich from Illinois will be joined by Chancellor Bergenau of UC Berkeley and Director Steve Chu, Nobel Prize winner and director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, announced that Berkeley and Berkeley Lab have won the $500 million BP Energy Biosciences Initiative. And one of the things that sealed the deal, by the way, was the fact that the governor was able to willing to put up $70 million as not as matching funds, but as part of that. So while I agree with the dean very strongly that letting peer review processes proceed because they really work well is the smartest thing to do, in this case, at least, putting our money where our mouth was and where our proposal was did turn out to be somewhat helpful. So what's next for biofuel opportunities? First of all, we're going to see new technologies for many, many reasons. I think we're moving towards what I like to call markets for green biofuels, where we actually know that the environmental performance of the biofuel is enhanced. And we're going to see this in California. We're going to see this in Europe. And if you wanted to improve the innovation potential and really accelerate the development of fuels in Minnesota, a low-carbon fuel standard might be something that would be appealing and helpful here in Minnesota as well. And this would yield, I think, in the end, a subsidy-free market for value-added commodities, which I think many people would like to see. I think we'll see performance standards and market forces that will be transformative in the vehicle technology and fuel supply. Right now, myself at UC Berkeley and also Dan Sperling at UC Davis are helping the state to evaluate low-carbon fuel options. We understand that California is not an island, and we will not solve either the petroleum nor the climate change challenge by ourselves. And we welcome people to join us. With that, I thank you.
Wonderful. Are there questions for members? I can tell we are going to be taking all of our time with this presentation. So those of you who are here for DNR, we will see you next Tuesday, and we'll not schedule anything else during that time. With that, I would just want to let DNR know, and if we would want to bring our next presenter there, I don't see any questions. If the members have questions right now?
Madam Chair, if I could just intervene for a moment. It turns out that our third speaker had another engagement and had to leave, so we will be not having...
Madam Chair, I'm the one that must apologize, because I will need to leave shortly. I knew that it was important actually to meet with the biofuels industry, and making a trip to Minneapolis provided that opportunity. So I'll actually be going to meet with a number of folks from the community here in Minnesota, and so I do have to apologize for my hasty departure.
Well, we certainly appreciate your coming. Do you have time for one question?
I do.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. I was interested in one of the goals possibly being a subsidy-free situation created by a low-carbon fuel standard. And I guess the question I have in general, and maybe since you're ahead of us in California with some of this, one of the things I do wonder is the return on the subsidies that we do spend in terms of affordability to the public beyond the environmental benefits. So, for example, I guess I'll leave it at that. You know, there's a public good that we're talking about here, and so reducing the cost of the end products in some cases, I know, would be the question I guess I'm trying to get at.
Madam Chair and Representative, thanks very much for the question. As the biofuels industry expands, if the subsidy structure stays as it is, the size of those subsidies will also expand and become rather large. I think there is a difference between the way a small and just starting out industry needs to be supported and the way a large-scale industry gets developed. It is true that in every place you look in the energy sector, there's a subsidy for every type of energy. There's a subsidy for nuclear energy. There's a subsidy for wind. There's a subsidy for biofuels everywhere. And this is something that the more we get away from, the more stable the industry will actually be. By providing strong incentives for markets in which biofuels are inherently competitive, that, I think, unleashes not subsidies, but investment by the private sector, which is far larger and, I think, far more effective.
And Chair, does that seem to you that would lead to the public actually having lower costs end product?
Madam Chair and Representative, I think that that is likely to be the case. By providing incentives for competition among the fuels, competition is what drives costs down. And competition is what's going to help industries develop new technologies and, yes, hopefully spend the, for one thing, spend the price rises that are due to market power in the world oil market.
Thank you. We appreciate your coming to Minnesota and to this city. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Inaldi, would you like to present your last testimony?
Madam Chair, members of the committees, thank you very much. I'd like to now bring Eric Larson from the Princeton Environmental Institute, Princeton University. Professor Larson, please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity and for extending our time a bit so I could speak. My name is Eric Larson. I'm on the research faculty at Princeton University, and I've been there since 1983 doing energy technology assessment, energy systems analysis across a wide variety of energy resources and technologies, a major part of which has been biomass. And I might just mention that I went to Princeton after finishing my engineering PhD here at the U. So it's nice to be back. A lot of what I'm going to say has already been said, and so I can speed it up a bit. And I wanted to start with just this, which is a graph showing the ethanol production in the U.S. historically and the target that President Bush just announced for the for his 2017 goal. And what you can see is there's a huge, and everybody understands this is a huge increase in renewable biofuels, and it's going to take lots of technologies and lots of effort to reach that goal. And that point has been made well by several of the preceding speakers. As far as biofuels go, it's not strictly a matter, as far as technology goes, it's not strictly science and engineering. There are different objectives that one wants to meet with biofuels. Greenhouse gases has been mentioned, energy security has been mentioned, land reclamation has been mentioned, rural development. There, it's unusual for an energy source to have so many potential objectives that can be fulfilled, and one has to weigh the costs and benefits of meeting these different objectives as you go forward with creating policy. So I'm going to just mention a few issues that come up with biofuels and talk about the technologies and how they relate to some of these issues, land requirements, state-of-the-art of technology, how sophisticated does it need to be, how big does it need to be, what kind of economics are there, environmental impacts, of course, and sustainability, compatibility with existing fuel infrastructures, and then, of course, the competing uses for biomass. Just real briefly, the sort of a terminology thing. First generation was mentioned, and I think everybody's familiar. That's corn ethanol and soy biodiesel primarily in this country. The second generation is really defined by the type of biomass that you're using, and lignocellulosic biomass is what defines a second generation technology. And there are two distinct types of second generation technologies: the ethanol via enzymatic hydrolysis, which has been mentioned prominently here, and then thermochemical fuels, which is a gasification based fuel production. And there are a whole slew of different end products that you can get from thermochemical conversion. And this is a, you can study when you're at home later. but it basically shows you the different pathways for first generation and second generation fuels. And the main point I want to make here is that if you look at the blue boxes, I don't know if that's readable, but the blue boxes represent second generation. And in particular, the box that starts with lignocellulosic biomass has two arrows to the left and three arrows coming out the top. The one furthest to the left goes to the box called gasification. And there's another arrow coming into that box, which is coal. And this technology for gasification and then synthesis and then production of these various thermochemical fuels is technology that's basically already well established in the fossil fuel industry. So there's some considerable piggybacking potential there. That's a bit different from the situation with the ethanol approach, which requires some of these breakthroughs in enzymes and so on. This is just, again, actually this talk, you might sort of call it Biofuels 101, because I'm just showing you sort of some of the issues that are involved. In this case, the liquid biofuels that you can make, I've shown a whole slew of them on the left-hand side, including down second from the bottom is dimethyl ether that was mentioned, and shows you where you can substitute existing fuels. So up at the top you have ethanol, which is a gasoline substitute, as we all know. But as you move down, you'll see Fischer-Tropsch, for example, which is a well-established technology for starting with natural gas and with coal. You can make diesel fuel if you make gasoline. Dimethyl ether, as Bob mentioned, is a substitute for diesel in a vehicle, but it's also an excellent LPG substitute. And depending on the fuel that you're making and depending on the feedstock that you're using, you get very different efficiencies, in quotes, efficiencies of biomass use. And what I've shown here is the transportation services, which is ultimately what you're after. How many kilometers or miles can you drive with a given amount of biomass input? And what I've shown it is on a per hectare basis here. So it's how many miles per acre, essentially, that you're getting out of your biomass. And if you, on the left-hand end is soy diesel in the Netherlands. The second one from the left is corn ethanol in the U.S. And then as you go to the right, we're starting to get into both different fuels and different conversion technologies. So right near the middle, there's ethanol from sugarcane in Brazil, which is a much more efficient land use than ethanol from corn. So you're almost double the amount of vehicle miles that you get per acre. And as you go further to the right, you get to the kinds of enzymatic hydrolysis technologies, ethanol from wood, advanced technology there. You can see is a factor of maybe 3 greater than what we get from corn today. And methanol from wood by gasification is a thermochemical route, also very, very good route. So what you choose in terms of your feedstock and your conversion technologies and your end fuel makes a big difference in how effectively you use your land resource, which is ultimately the limiting resource. So just to summarize some of the characteristics, first generation biofuels, positive aspects I think we're all aware of, the limitations I think we're also all aware of, and so I don't think I'll spend time going through those. Second generation liquid biofuels, characterized by being made from lignocellulose. The feedstocks, you generally can't eat them, so they don't compete with food directly. You can breed the feedstocks for the energy characteristics that you want if you're not worried about having to breed them for food. And importantly, you can use much more of the biomass, above ground biomass, and convert it to fuel than you can with the first generation where you're just using the corn kernels, for example. Much more in the way of energy and environmental benefits, and Alexander Farrell referred, for example, to the greenhouse gas, and John Sheehan as well. You can blend them with petroleum fuels in most cases. One drawback is that typically there's more capital cost involved in these technologies, and the trade-off is that you have a lower feedstock cost. And so but the fact that you have higher capital costs mean you generally want to build these things bigger than you build the first generation technologies, and that of course has all sorts of implications. And the last point here, thermochemical and biological second generation fuels are different, and I want to just spend a minute on that. Second generation biological is what everybody calls cellulosic ethanol, and that's what everybody is talking about primarily. With current technology, there's a limited fraction of the biomass that you're able to convert to fuel, and that's where the R&D is needed to break those barriers. There are microorganisms that need to be tailored to the specific feedstock as well, so that's another somewhat of a limitation as opposed to being able to use any feedstock in a given facility. So we need R&D breakthroughs to improve the conversion efficiencies and reduce costs, and there are a number of companies and as well as research institutes, as we've heard, who are working on these to try to get these breakthroughs. And there are a few commercial facilities that are starting to work with the sort of the first generation and second generation cellulosic ethanol. On the thermochemical side, just a quick summary there, Fischer-Tropsch fuels, dimethyl ether, methanol to gasoline, mixed alcohols, these are all fuels that can be made via gasification. And with gasification, you're essentially feeding the whole biomass, any type of biomass, into a reactor that converts it into a synthesis gas, which is carbon monoxide and hydrogen, and then you combine those two molecules over, depending on the catalyst you choose, and come out with whatever fuel you're interested in. And those catalysts are available in most cases from the fossil fuel industry for making these fuels, so there's no real breakthroughs needed on that score. The case of mixed alcohols is a little bit different. That one isn't as far along. And there's one commercial scale demonstration going on in Germany with this overall idea. There need to be more commercial scale demonstrations to show that you can do this with biomass. And as I mentioned earlier on, there's a large overlap and synergies with commercially established fossil fuel technologies. And this really presents some unique opportunities that tend not to be seen by folks who are working in the biomass field, because they're working in the biomass field, and you have folks working in the coal fields independently.
I'm here to burn your house.
The final bullet here is that with gasification, and this is a bit longer term than what we're talking about mostly here this morning, but not too much longer term, it facilitates carbon dioxide capture and underground storage, as opposed to not the kind of underground storage that Bob was talking about in roots and soil, but deep underground in saline aquifers, for example. And this is an idea that is getting a lot of attention worldwide. There are a number of large demonstration projects going on to show that you can capture CO2 from fossil fuels and put it underground for long periods of time without, on the order of hundreds of years, without significant leakage. And you can do this with thermochemical biofuels as well. You can capture some of the CO2 during the conversion process, and then you become a really carbon negative, even more so than what Bob was talking about with soil carbon. And biomass is the only renewable resource that has this potential, because it's a carbon-based resource. And my second to last slide is a little preview of a slide that my colleague Bob Williams is going to show this afternoon. And it tries to highlight both the CO2 capture aspect as well as the synergies between coal and biomass. And so what I've shown here is the amount of biomass that you would need to produce a single unit of liquid fuel, low carbon or zero carbon liquid fuel. The right hand side, I've shown various generations of cellulosic ethanol technology. What's understood currently is the tallest bar there. What's on the right hand side is sort of close to the theoretical maximum. And on the left hand side, what I've shown is a system which we've done significant analysis on, where you combine both gasification of biomass and gasification of coal, and you capture carbon dioxide along the way and store it underground. And now in order to come up with a net zero carbon emission liquid fuel, the amount of biomass that you need is about a third of the total energy input. The rest is coming from coal, but you're capturing CO2 from coal, so you're not putting those emissions into the atmosphere. So in terms of CO2 emissions, these four bars are equivalent. But in terms of the amount of biomass you're using, it's much less in the case where you're combining it with coal. And so you've extended your biomass resource by a factor of 3 or 4 or 5, which, again, land is the limiting constraint. So more details on this come to the symposium this afternoon. All right, last slide, take-home messages. We need second-generation biofuels. Everybody's came into the room knowing that, I think. Second-generation biofuels equals cellulosic biofuels, but I would say does not equal cellulosic ethanol. And this, despite the comments that were made that we need lots of different technologies, if you listen around the discussions here and most places where biofuels are discussed, it's cellulosic ethanol. And I particularly like Alex Farrell's presentation in the California program with the low carbon fuel standard, because it explicitly doesn't pick a winner. It provides an incentive to have the best technologies be the ones that make it to the marketplace. And there's the danger of picking a winner, like saying cellulosic ethanol is the one we're going to back. If you pick the wrong one, you're lost. So to contribute in the market, cellulosic ethanol requires some R&D breakthroughs and commercial demonstrations. Thermochemical fuels need commercial demonstrations. And some of you may remember a project in Minnesota called MINVAP. The Minnesota Valley Alfalfa Growers Cooperative had put together a big project to demonstrate gas thermochemical, in that case it was electricity generation, but basically the same technology that you need for thermochemical fuels. And it went quite far along, but ultimately didn't go to actual project. But it's those kinds of projects, those kinds of demonstrations, I think, that we need in all area, all kinds of technologies. And then finally, encouraging creative ways to co-utilize biomass with fossil fuels, which again requires getting very different partners together, stakeholders to pursue these kinds of ideas, really could, in the longer term, could really greatly increase the effectiveness with which you can produce low carbon fuels from biomass. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Representative Osmond has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering about the an issue that hasn't really been presented up there, and that is water consumption. I'm assuming that with ethanol, whether it's from corn, which has the potential of competing with our food or for livestock food, as well as going towards cellulose helps us in that area. But if we go towards ethanol from cellulose, don't we still have a huge water consumption in order to produce that versus the type of water consumption you have in the thermochemical processes? Or am I wrong in that assumption?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's an excellent question, and it's clearly an issue that needs to be examined. I can't say that I know the answer directly. I believe that with thermochemical fuels, there is a significant water requirement as well. So that's something that would have to get looked at more carefully. There may be somebody who's looked at that.
Is there anyone else from the presenter team that can address that question?
It's an excellent question for those who may not be aware. A limiting factor in Minnesota is water. It would not be intuitive given all our lakes, but it certainly is a limiting factor.
Madam Chair, I can add just a little bit of information. It is absolutely the case that there's a significant amount of water consumption that goes into the ethanol process. Our designs estimate something on the order of 4 to 5 gallons of water per gallon of fuel that you're putting out. So I think among the issues of sustainability, whether it's thermochemical or fermentation processes, the water issue absolutely must be addressed. From the farming perspective, none of the analysis we ever do ever considers irrigated land. Not only is that a problem in terms of the added pressure on water supplies if you rely on irrigation for your production, but also the energy balance associated with it is just terrible. So these are the kinds of issues that must be addressed as we move forward.
Madam Chair, Representative, the numbers are comparable to thermochemical and
okay, there you go. We just inform each other.
I suspect Representative Osmond is also thinking of something that we funded with LCCMR, which was gasification, that in my recollection, perhaps Representative Tingle said, didn't require any water. Am I right about that, Representative Tingleston?
Mm-hmm. No. For ethanol production?
No, for gasification.
Madam Chair, I was just chatting with the LCMR staff. It was the water-free paralysis process, so.
Yeah, so that is something we have just recently or in the process of funding in Minnesota, and so and one of the reasons, of course, is because of our lack of water. So are you all working on that particular issue at all?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that particular process would not have the same kind of water requirements as the kinds of fuels, the second generation fuels that I was talking about. You're making a synthetic crude oil, which isn't nearly as refined, and so that's where the difference comes.
There are several questions.
Madam Chair, a quick follow-up to this. Is the assumption that the 4 to 5 gallons can't be reused? I guess that is of significance to me. Can we reuse the 4 and 5 gallons over, or is it some reason we can only use it one time?
Madam Chair, Representative, some of the water requirement is cooling water, which can be reused with the proper design of your cooling system. There's some consumption of water as well, so you would need to supply water that way. And on the thermochemical side, if John wants to say something on the other.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, water recycle is already something that's considered in the designs that we do. And even with that recycle, there's still that kind of water consumption. This is a genuine issue that we need to manage.
Representative, I have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and what a fascinating discussion this morning. Just a great panel you put together, Dean Aldi. Appreciate that. Dr. Larson, I've got a question for you. In your presentation, you talked about the size of scale of production facilities, and really, in your estimation, as I understood it, need to be large commercial or industrial-sized, facilities to produce lignocellulosic ethanol. Is that, am I correct in assuming that in your presentation?
Madam Chair, Representative, the scale generally, the bigger you can build things, the cheaper you're going to make the fuels. And I think I've looked harder at the thermochemical side, and John can perhaps answer on the other, but I think they're similar in that the scale that you need is is going to be larger than the corn ethanol type scales, the average corn ethanol type scales. And just to put some numbers on it, I think the NREL folks use 2,000 dry tons of biomass coming into the plant per day. So that's the size of a medium-sized pulp mill, maybe. But if you can go bigger than that, that would be better for the economics. But then there are logistics issues.
Well, Madam Chair, would you envision then that some of the future of lignocellulosic-based ethanol would be located probably next to an existing ethanol plant, if you're going to use corn stover, for example, or prairie grass, or whatever you're going to use? Is there some synergies between having it next to an ethanol plant, basically, is what I'm asking?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a very good question. I think my first level of response is yes, there's definitely a great deal of potential there. One of the keys as new corn ethanol plants get built is that they make some accommodation for future bringing in of other materials, and that would even improve the ability to get that synergy. But you know, clearly the corn ethanol plants are located and make use of a distribution system for biomass that we should be trying to tap into.
I think we could ask questions for another half an hour, but we cannot do that. I saw two more questions, and with that, we will be adjourning. Representative Clark.
This will be brief, I think. Maybe I missed it, but did any of you talk about the impact on the soil, you know, the nutrients of the soil, what kind of soil we end up with these various approaches, and if so, or if you didn't, is that something that someone has been looking at? So as you take you take everything off the soil and you make it into fuel, and then what's left in the soil, do you have to put a lot of amendments back on the soil and the cost of that, and what are we doing to the earth in the end? That's kind of my question. I don't know if I missed it today or did I miss it? Did you come back?
You want to? Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I addressed it only partly in that one slide that showed the root structure of a perennial prairie. The secret to this, we believe, to restore soil health and the carbon capturing capacity of soil is to grow mixed perennial crops as energy crops. In that case, the health of that soil ecosystem is being restored and maintained over the long haul. So we think this is, in fact, one of the few ways we can imagine the vast, what used to be tall grass prairies, being restored to health that will also impact water in terms of watersheds and what we're currently doing to the Mississippi watershed and ultimately the Gulf of Mexico.
And Representative Knuth has the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before this question, you were sort of talking about the distribution network of biomass, and you know, bigger is better in terms of scale of what you're trying to do and cost, but is there any work being done on the limitations of how big these plants could be based on the fact that we have to move a lot of plant material to actually make these products?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there is work. I mentioned Idaho National Laboratory is doing research into looking at new designs for distribution, collection and distribution of biomass. One thing we know very clearly is that whether you're talking about prairie grasses or corn stover, today the only way you can get those to a conversion facility is to bale them and put them on a truck. Our estimates are that for a 2,000 ton per day facility, this would involve trucks coming in about every 3 minutes into a facility. So it amplifies the need to move to completely different approaches to handling the biomass.
Okay. Dinaldi with final words.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committees. I just wanted to add that among the research efforts we're conducting at University of Minnesota are methods to densify biomass, both by physical, chemical, mechanical means, as well as thermal means of densifying biomass to address some of these problems about transportation and bringing resource to the plant that will ultimately produce fuel. So with that, I thank you greatly for
thank
your
attention. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you.
To that point, Madam Chair, with regard to the size of the cost of fuel at this issue, there's research at the University of Minnesota that's ongoing to actually reduce the processing activity to where it can actually be taken to the farm potentially in the future. So there are multiple ways of dealing with that.
I think we're going to have some discussions about that. I would like to thank the chairs from the other committees. Very much for coming, Representative Dunkey, Representative Mahoney, Representative Eakin. Thank you for coming. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.